You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
Today's panel on the role of religion in diplomacy and peacemaking in the Middle East. It's a topic of great interest to many. Thank you so much for joining. This topic has been an area of great interest to MEI scholar Alan Kieswetter, who co-chaired the Working Group on Religion and Diplomacy at the U.S. Islamic World Forum in Doha, Qatar in 2013. That led to a report entitled Diplomacy and Religion, Seeking Common Interests and Engagement in a Dynamically Changing and Turbulent World, which I hope you picked up on the way in. It's just the first few pages. You can find the rest of the report at the Brookings website. In any case, I want to thank Alan very, very much for taking the initiative to organize today's panel. I think we need to bring as many disciplines into the discussion of diplomacy as possible. And I gather from Alan there may be others in the work, so he will keep you posted. I also want to thank our two very distinguished guests for joining us today. It's an honor and a deep privilege to hear their insights and perspectives about how clerics can engage in this very important role of diplomacy and peacemaking. So thank you all, and I'd like to hand the panel over to Alan.
Well, thank you for coming, and to the Muslims in our audience, Ramadan Kareem. I'd like to start by just quoting Secretary of State Kerry when he announced the appointment of his new special advisor for interfaith initiatives. He said, "We ignore the global impact of religion, in my judgment, at our peril." And afterwards, he instructed Department of State diplomats to go out and engage religious leaders and faith-based communities in our day-to-day work, build strong relationships with them, and listen to their insights and understand the important contributions that they can make individually and that we can make together. Now, this is a new attitude. It's a new attitude towards cooperation between diplomats and religion that goes back at least to the beginning of the Obama administration, but starting much earlier. There is another attitude. I am a diplomat. I have spent 36 years working in the Middle East largely. And for a long time, Madeleine Albright, in her book called The Mighty and the Almighty, characterized the attitudes this way. Many practitioners of foreign policy, including me, have sought to separate religion from politics, to liberate logic from beliefs that transcend logic. So, after this, later in the book, says she has a different point of view now, so I have to be fair to her. But this is a standard State Department approach that has persisted for many years and is now changing. This is the first of two panels on religion and diplomacy. This one will feature religious perspectives as brought to us by these highly experienced clerics, who have been involved in religion and diplomacy for a long time. And the second will be in August and will feature U.S. officials and others who, frankly, couldn't make it today. So but there is more to come. And my role is both to moderate and to some extent, embody the diplomatic side of the discussion. The report that Kate mentioned identifies four ways that religion can facilitate diplomacy. One is advice. The second is track to diplomacy. A third is hands-on projects. And a fourth is creating a community of shared values. Cardinal McCarrick and Ayatollah Dr. Erivani are extraordinary interfaith diplomats. Let me just give you some of my personal notes of their activities in the past year. Cardinal McCarrick is an advisor to the Secretary of State as a member of the National Interreligious Leadership Initiative. and offers perspectives to that forum on Middle East issues. He's traveled with Pope Francis to Jerusalem and the Middle East. He's traveled with the Conference of Bishops to Qom in March. And this is not to mention the fact he is under State Department auspices, been to Africa, I believe twice, and has just gotten back from a trip to China. As regard to Ayatollah Dr. Erivani, he too is extraordinary. He has his religious degrees from Qom. He has a PhD in Western philosophy. He wrote his dissertation on the French Catholic philosopher Jacques Maritain. And I would suggest that he probably knows more about that than anybody else in this room, unless perhaps the exception.
No contest.
No contest. He has founded his own organization, the Center for the Study of Islam in the Middle East, where it takes a very active role in religion and diplomacy. And maybe the highest honor I can tell you in a family way is he is demonstrably better at IT than his children. So that's I would like to begin with a general question about religion and diplomacy, and we will discuss this in the first part of the conversation. And then after that, we will move to specific issues, starting with Iran, and as we have time, Iraq and the Middle East situation in general. So, for the two of you, I would like to ask the question, in your personal experience, what has been the scope for cooperation between religion and diplomacy? And what have been the limitations? Think back, and when has it worked? When has it been effective? What are the attitudes that you would seek to convey to others?
Well, I can start because because I'm so much older than anybody else here, that I therefore go back a long way. But I can start by remembering about 25 years ago, our State Department, and I don't know where the impetus came from. I've never found that out. But our State Department began to consider the question of religion and diplomacy. They did it with hesitation, and as Alan mentioned, they did it with hesitation because of the great strictures on separation of church and state that we all live under here in the United States. And so they didn't want to get involved in other countries, what to do what they couldn't get involved here. However, they formed about 20, 25 years ago an advisory committee on religion as part of the State Department. And I was a member of it. I was Archbishop in New Jersey at the time. I remember coming down and meeting a very interesting group of religious friends and friends to become during that time. And the different people from the State Department came and spoke to us about what they were doing and the methodologies that they were using. And it became very clear that whereas we in our State Department preparation for our ambassadors and for other officials were very concerned about the political situation in a country, the agricultural situation in a country, to a certain extent the cultural situation in a country, the governmental situation, the military situation, all those many faceted ideas that our people were supposed to send back to Washington, but nobody ever looked at the religious situation in a country. Now, partly, I guess, it was because of the dangers of violating that separation of church and state. That may have been part of it. But at the end of the road, they knew very little about what was going on in religion, and they were not encouraged to get a handle on it. I'm sure that many who were, say, Christian or Jewish, found that their faiths were represented in most of the countries that they visited, and I'm sure that in many cases they formed relationships there. But it was very much on a personal basis, and no way were they reporting on what they found to the State Department. I remember Robert David Saperstein was a member of that group, the man who I used to always sit next to, because we all always got the idea of that we would leave early because the meeting started to stretch out. So this one too, you may leave to any time at your Alamo mine. I know how important that is to be able to escape if you want to. But I used to sit next to Waladin Mohammed, who was the very important and fascinating leader of the black Muslims in the United States. A wonderful man, and a great philosopher himself, and a great ecumenist in a certain sense himself. But anyway, so there were people from many different roads of religious life, and we, to a person, we said, you do not know the country unless you know the religion of the country. You do not know the country unless you know where religion fits in to their outlook, to their understanding of themselves. And ultimately, we issued such a strong recommendation that the Congress picked it up, and just a few years after that, there was a bill on religious freedom, which created the Federal Commission on International Freedom of Religion. And it was an outcome, really, of that committee that we belonged to. There were six or seven of us, I forget now. But I was a member of that, and we began to study just the religious issues. And in a very special way, we began to study the difficulties that some countries would put in the practice of religion. And we made visits to the countries. We brought people in to talk to us about it. And this was an official federal commission, so that it was a big change from what we had had before. And also at the same time, and I may not have the right vocabulary for this, but at the same time, the ambassadors were told to give a report on freedom of religion in the countries that they were assigned to. And that was a big change, because it gave the United States a chance to see what was going on in the light of religion. So it was a major change. What Ambassador Allen was saying is absolutely true. In the beginning, we had almost nothing except what people would pick up on their own. But then they began to see the need, and this federal commission, one thing I forgot, and also an assistant secretary for religious freedom was named at that time.
And Ambassador Pickering has observed that every context in which a diplomat works has a religious component, and it's necessary to know this, to be able to try to learn, to influence. Ayatollah Erivani?
Yes. Good morning, everyone. It's really my honor to be here among you, dear distinguished audiences, and also distinguished panelists. Thank you for arranging and putting this meeting together, Professor Case Wither. And also, I'm very honored to be in a panel that my mentor and my dear friend, Cardinal McCarrick, is a part of that. We have been working together, I think, more than 13 years. I mean, when two countries, I mean, unfortunately for years, had lots of misunderstanding, after immediately the invasion of Iraq, we were able to make a very important trip to Iran. That trip, I think, played a very important role in preventing a new war against Iran and taking two nations in the new war. So we know each other, and I'm very honored again to be here with you, Cardinal. And thank you for all your support and the work you are doing in this very difficult task. To answer your question, Professor Kiswitter, I want to clarify a word of diplomacy.
Okay.
You know, we all somehow agree about or know a common sense about the meaning of religion. But when it comes to relation between religion and diplomacy. Then when I was, last night I was looking at different dictionaries to find out the meaning of diplomacy. This is what they have said, mainly in those dictionaries, that a kind of conduct by government officials of negotiations and other relations between nations, the art or science of conducting such negotiations, the work of maintaining good relations between the government and different, between government of different countries. So I think what maybe you have in your mind, at least what I have in my mind, is not in narrow sense of that definition of diplomacy. We really want to find out and see to what extent the government officials, policy makers, have acknowledged the role of religion within the society, and to what extent religious leaders and thinkers are recognizing or willing to help or cooperate with policy makers. Diplomacy is usually is a kind of method that can apply it by anyone, which usually in some way sometimes has a negative even content part of that. So we don't want to get into that. I just wanted to clarify it. When I'm talking, then I use a broader meaning of that diplomacy. However, as we might get into more details later on, we all know that the religion in many countries in the Middle East, the majority of the people are Muslim. And Islam, unlike some other religions, at current situation, is a part of politics, is integrated with politics in general terms. Now, when it comes to its relation to the state, we have some countries that religion and state are integrated with each other. So really, it's very hard to make a distinction between like a relation between diplomacy and religion. They are both integrated with each other. Let's, for example, as an example, Iran, as a country that, as we know, that clergy is somehow running the country. I mean, the supreme leader is a clergyman who is the number one man who is in charge of the state. So here again, the other clarification here, I think we should make attention to when we talk about the role of diplomacy or religion in diplomacy, then we should talk about outsiders, mainly West, Europe, and America, to what extent they have to take religion seriously in their policy makings. Otherwise, in the Middle East, religion is there. There are religious scholars who are diplomats. Look at Iraq as well. Look at the parliament of Iraq. Look at the other countries. They are mainly religious people who are playing a role of diplomat. And they have diplomacy or using diplomacy for their whatever they want to achieve. So that's not a big issue there. The big issue here, to what extent Western countries, in particular American policy, should bring into attention the religious elements. As Cardinal said, and you also mentioned, there has been a kind of willingness and understanding of the religious role within the region, but that unfortunately has been limited to diplomats, mainly, not to the other parts of the administration. Here I want to take it a broader meaning of that. So when, for example, it goes to the military part, when it goes to the intelligence part, they are not using the same kind of, or they do not have the same kind of approach and understanding of a U.S. diplomat has these days. I'm very proud of when I see diplomats, of the U.S. diplomats, in different occasions when I'm talking to them, I see that now they started understanding the role of religion, and they are learning. They are eager to learn. But unfortunately, the other parts, as far as my limited knowledge shows, is not as they are. So We might discuss it later on, sure, as our discussion and suggestions on how we can improve that kind of understanding.
I certainly endorse the idea of a broad concept of diplomacy. And in the Department of State, there is traditional diplomacy, of course. And then there are lots of other types of diplomacy too, and including public diplomacy, which plays a very large role. And more recently, there's a Bureau of Conflict and Stability Operations, which is featuring religious diplomacy in the Middle East. And this will be a particular topic for next time. But Ayatollah Erivani, I think you have introduced very well what I would like to talk about next, which is the fact that both of you have been to Iran in recent months. You have just returned, I think, on July 1st, and Cardinal, I believe you were there in March. Cardinal, why don't you tell us about the visit of the Conference of Catholic Bishops to Qom?
It was a very interesting visit, obviously. Iran is a very interesting country, and a very gracious country in receiving guests. All the times I've been there, including the time when Bishop Chain and I went to get them to the hikers. Remember the hikers of a few years ago? We were able to bring them back, and so that was a crucial time. But we always met great courtesy and great interest on their part. What the bishops wanted to do, because the Catholic community, as many other communities in the United States, has played a very, very strong role in being against nuclear weapons. The statement of the Catholic bishops about 20 years ago against nuclear armament is still one of the strongest documents against that. I remember I was a bishop then, and we remember the discussion, even the feeling by many bishops that you couldn't even have a deterrent force, that was not moral. And ultimately, the decision was, for the time being, until you straightened everything out, it would be possible to have a deterrent force so that you would speak from some strength as you went to negotiations. But I think that our visit then had something to do with that. As you know, the Supreme Leader has issued a many statements about the armaments that can destroy the world, and especially nuclear weapons of mass destruction. And he's spoken very, very clearly and very, very forcefully about that. And as a matter of fact, has issued a fatwa, which is in itself a very strong document, saying that it is against Islam to have or to use or to prepare weapons of mass destruction on the nuclear level. Of course, there are other voices in the United States who say, oh, they're only kidding, that's not true. And the bishop said, let's go over and talk about what a fatwa really is. Is it just an opinion? Is it a theological statement? Is it a mandate from an ecclesiastical authority? And so that was really the basis of our travel over there, that we spoke to many of the ayatollahs about that question. We discussed it because we had been discussing it here in the United States to try to find the essential characteristics of this fatwa, in view of the fact that there are many voices in the United States who say this fatwa doesn't count. It's not reasonable. It's not serious, and we can't go by it. We found to advance the conversation. We found that as far as those we spoke to, thank you. I'm going to talk more loudly. I hold my thing about it. We found that when all is said and done, the fatwa in Shiite Islam of a supreme leader, of a man of his importance in the community, was very, very important, and was a document which had to be obeyed religiously. And so those who said, no, this can be, it's just an opinion, we found that, that as far as the people we spoke to over there, it was much more than that. This was a declaration, such as, say, that the Pope would give to the Catholic people, a declaration that would be, that very rarely this would happen, but a declaration that would be infallible or, and not, and necessary to follow by Catholic people everywhere. So there was a relationship there. So that was really the reason for our going over. There were two reasons, of course. The first reason was we wanted to, I had been there over times before, but they wanted to see Iran and talk to the religious leaders and get a sense of religion in that area. But then this was the key subject that, that we thought we needed to talk about.
I told Irani, before we go on to your trip, I'd like to just ask a few questions from your point of view as a religious scholar about a fatwa. And here I'm sort of speaking as a diplomat, and the negotiations are going on in Vienna as we speak. There could be not a more important issue than the credibility given to the word and the promises of the Iranian government that they do not want a nuclear weapon. So one of the things that diplomats say is, why isn't it written down? If it's serious, it'll be written down. There will be words to parse and to analyze. And a second objection that comes is it's only as good as the, in this case, supreme leader who issue it continues to be alive. So there are limits to it. So how do you answer these sort of, I would call, dotting the I's and crossing the T's type questions that would come from diplomats?
Yes, you know, the time is so limited, and to answering this...
short answer, please.
It's very difficult. I know Cardinal spent a few days with scholars in Qom just talking about all these difficulties and different questions. However, to in very short reply to your questions, the first one, I think that the leader, when issues the fatwa, or talks, when says something, there is a kind of a sense of understanding when someone, leader or Grand Ayatollah or Marja, when he says something. And when we understand it as the people who are listening and the followers, they don't care if it's written down or it has been said. Even verbally saying it is even more important than writing it down. Because writing it down sometimes maybe has been written by his secretary or whatever. But when he comes and says something, then it's considered a kind of insult to the Iranian culture and custom when someone says something, even you tell him, write it down for me. They say, you don't accept my word? What kind of person you are? I'm talking as a whole entity here and telling you this, and you want me to write it down? However, I mean, what the words of leader, he has said in many different occasions, has been written down as well, and in his website in different ways. So that's in short. We can go more into details. And now, towards the second part, when it's the validity of a fatwa applies to the time of that issuer of fatwa is alive, that somehow is correct. But here the case is different. Ayatollah Khamenei has two, like, different hats. One is, like, as an Ayatollah who issues the fatwa, and the other one, as I said earlier, he's the head of a state. So when the head of a state, as a head of a state, says something, is more than just issuing a fatwa as a pure fatwa of a clergy saying that. So the whole country are becoming responsible for his words and what he is saying. So breaking it down would be very difficult and too costly for the country if they want to break it. So I think we should take advantage of that. We should take advantage of that. Respect that fatwa and try to take as a point of going ahead for reaching to a peace solution.
Tell us about your trip, because I know you took a group of American religious leaders for a week or 2 weeks, and you visited, I think, several places in Iran. So what was the purpose of your visit, and what were the results?
Again, in short, you know, one of the benefit of traveling together, these people, we were 8 people. Although I knew all of them, but these 8 people, they did not know each other very well. So the first purpose of this kind of trip is these people are finding lots of time to spend with each other, which they don't have it here in the U.S. They were great people, the leader of churches, scholars, and they found that opportunity. And we have a saying from our prophet, Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, Prophet Muhammad, and we have other hadiths saying that if you want to know someone, go into the trip, have a journey with him. You know people better inside the journey when they are traveling with each other. So that by itself made us become closer with each other. And I remember the trip which we made in 2003 with Cardinal. The people who were inside of that trip, they did not know each other. And since then, they became friends. And out of that, hundreds of different works have been produced out of that friendship. So that's something which...
Give us an idea of the range of interests. And you mentioned, I think there was an evangelical minister.
Yeah, we were 8 people, myself, and there was Dr. Said from ISNA, Islamic Council of America, as a Muslim representative. Then the rest 6 were mainly Christians. Unfortunately, although I invited a very important Jewish leader, a rabbi, but at the last he couldn't come, he couldn't make it. So we were left with Christians, although we wanted to have a Jewish representative, but it was too late to find another one, and he, at the last point, he had some problems, he couldn't join us, and we were not able to gain visa for other one or substitute him. However, the rest were great religious leaders as scholars. There was a pastor, Dr. Joel Hunter, who is a spiritual advisor to President Obama and who is leading a very mega church in Florida. There was Pastor Bob Roberts, Dr. Bob Roberts from Texas, who is again running a mega church and is very active in interfaith dialogue. There was a lady, Dr. Barbara William Skinner, who is an African-American clergy and very activist, who has been, her husband being a friend of Martin Luther, and she's a pioneer in combating all the kind of apartheid or whatever, and fighting for, human rights issues and women rights issues and black rights issues. So then we have my colleague and my friend, Professor Bob Destro from Catholic University. We had Dr. James Kowalski, the Dean of the Cathedral of St. John Cathedral of New York. We had Dr. Medley. Dr. Medley is the head of American Baptist Church and the Secretary of National Council of Churches of America. So we were a kind of this different kind of group. So that was one purpose. Then we start knowing each other better, creating a more trust and friendship. Now, the second purpose was, as you might know, President Rouhani announced this year the World Against Violence and Extremism, which we call it WAVE. And we wanted to go there, and there, we asked them, and also they were eager, our hosts, to have a different kind of meetings and panels to discuss the issue and to tell the Iranian, leaders that we as a religious people and religious leaders are here ready and committed to help these two great countries in different ways. When the leaders are willing now to negotiate, then we are ready also to contribute in different ways to that peace process. So that was the initiative and the intention of delegation. So we had like a meeting in Iran Institute of Philosophy, a few hours discussing with philosophers and thinkers of both sides. We had another panel of 6 hours that more than 100 of scholars were invited. Officials were there. So we discussed again. We had opportunities. We met with some officials. We met with communities, Christian communities, Jewish communities. We went to Isfahan. We went to Qom. So it was a discovering every moment of that for my friends, I think they couldn't stop showing their happiness and their feelings when they were facing different kind of hospitalities, especially when it comes to not only spiritual food, but to the physical food. Yeah. So I think everyone was fed. And that made them here to go to the gym maybe twice a day to reduce.
So could you speak a little more about what you think were the important lessons that came from this interchange? Obviously of a group of important American religious figures who were talking both, I gather, to political and to religious, and more than that, general segments of society. What is the outcome? What did both sides learn from this trip about this sort of interpersonal, social, religious diplomacy?
Again, I wish they were here to tell you themselves. This is what at least I have heard from them, but I don't know, maybe they have some more to say. I'm not a good representative of others to talk about their personal experience, really. But however, I think both sides, I mean, it was a very, very informative kind of trip for both sides. I mean, people there, they didn't know, for example, President Obama cares about religion. When they saw that, I mean, President Obama, as a president of this important country, has a kind of spiritual advisor. It was a kind of shock for many of them to hear that. And that by itself, if you look at it, it's smooth and it gives a better kind of sympathy in our country towards American leadership. Because for us, for religious leaders in Iran, religious concept is the first priority. Then everything comes after. And then again, they were telling me, some of them, they said, we shouldn't tell you that. After having a lot of discussion with young ladies, and they saw many ladies in different kind of activities, and their English were good, and the way they were talking, or thinkers, philosophers, theologians, they told me, a few of them, we have been friends, and we have been going in different countries in the region, but the distance between your nation and your people and the other people in the region, with all respect, is huge in terms of the culture, in terms of understanding, in terms of technology, in terms of in getting involved, in terms of freedom of kind of ladies who are involved in different parts of their lives. So that was the other issue I think they saw. They saw the rich culture of Iran. They went to Isfahan. We went to Isfahan. I wish everyone goes there one day, and we pray for you to go. And here Dr. Desro is entering the room, who was with us. So, So, I mean, when we were, for example, in Isfahan, we went to the place called Julfa. It's a part of Isfahan, a very old part of Isfahan, that Christian, Jews, and Muslim are living together for centuries. You see the synagogue and different churches and mosques next to each other. So that was a sign of that people here are living, I mean, for centuries. When we met, for example, with Christian communities or I mean, they even maybe they didn't like even to be recognized as a Christian. They were more willing to be acknowledged as an Iranian. So we are all Iranian before all the religion came to us. So that's something put us together, bring us together. And these are things that people start to getting kind of direct. Now, when we go to the officials also, officials, when we met with different officials, they had some messages that they wanted religious leaders to take to their leaders here. Mm-hmm. So that was another opportunity and window that, I mean, people of the United States, religious leaders who less have attachment to the political issues, they are not for political positions, that to get a first kind of information from leaders of the other side who are not in the good connections with each other, with the leaders, political leaders here.
This is an interesting question, and let me bring both of you into this conversation. Secretary Kerry, reportedly, along with some of the other P5+1 foreign ministers, may be flying to Vienna sometime soon, to try to give a boost to the negotiations. If you were advising him, having been there, what would you say to him? I mean, if you, the phone rang and, you know, it's Air Force, whatever it is, 342, something, and the secretary would like to speak to you, what sort of message would you try to convey to him?
I would, not being a Shia Muslim, I am at a disadvantage, but I would, I certainly would say to him, don't ignore the fatwa of the Supreme Leader as you begin to make plans for the future. Perhaps it can be strengthened one way or the other, but for us who are religious people, we believe that religious directions are very important, and as we mentioned before, and as the Ayatollah mentioned before, this is not an off-the-cuff statement. This is a well thought of and well researched and well presented a dictum for the nation, for the Shiite Muslims in Iran, millions and millions of people, and they are. We believe they accept this as real doctrine. So I would say to Secretary Kerry, and I will if I have a chance, that you know, those who say that a fatwa is just a make believe, or a fatwa is just a temporary thing, or a fatwa is a joke or a trick or something, and our people say this, and it's disturbing to me as a person who believes in religious life and religious liberty and religious teaching.
Ayatollah Irvani, what would you say?
Yes, before, allow me just for testing the, yeah. Changing the test of the discussion, just your question remind me of something happened when we were in Iran together in 2003. I don't know if Father remember that or not. We were late when we wanted to depart the airport. We came when the Lufthansa was about to leave to depart. And so we were very upset. I mean, and then if there was, we are going to lose that connection. However, we went through VIP, and then I was able through using my clerical, influence, go to the security people and telling them, look, this is a very important delegation, and they have many things to do, and we have been late, but it has not been our fault. The security people delayed us. So could you please help us to take us into this plane? So the security said, clergyman or ayatollah or whatever, what I can do as a favor, I can... let you talk to the pilot inside the plane, and then see from there. He is the only one now, because the door is closed. He is the only one can open the door of the airplane. So I came to the cardinal. I told cardinal, I did my job. Now is your turn. Perhaps this man is a Christian guy or whatever. Maybe listen to you better. So, and I exactly remember, and I was sitting, listening to the conversation. He said, good morning. It was like 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. Good morning, my son. This is Cardinal Father so-and-so. And then he started his magic way of convincing the pilot that, to make the story short, in 2-3 minutes, he said, don't worry, I stay here in the middle of the line. He stopped the plane. We rushed to the plane, and then the baggage, we couldn't do anything, so the baggage is sent one day later. So that's how, cardinal can, if he gives that opportunity to talk to Kerry, I think he can change the whole aspect.
If I make a comment, I am almost positive that the pilot was a Muslim.
So now let's go to what you ask. If I see for secretary, I will, as I have told him before, I have seen him, I doubt he is going to listen 100%. But however, I'm going to tell him now, this is a unique opportunity that has been created for both nations in the whole time after revolution. always there was a missing part. Either Iranian wanted American Bernard Reddy or American wanted Iranian Bernard Reddy. This is the time that people of Iran peacefully, in their election last year, told the whole world, we want some changes. President Rouhani also came and promised to his nation and to the international community that we want to cooperate. We want to work with everyone. So they are now ready and determined. So Kerry should take this advantage and try to respect, try to acknowledge the greatness of this country, try to avoid any kind of humiliation towards this country. That's something they are going to reject it immediately. So the language of respect, the language of trust can pave the way. So as Cardinal said, the fatwa of Ayatollah, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei is very important. But that shouldn't be limited to that. There are many issues and opportunities these days that these two great countries can work together. It's not only, we shouldn't, I think, limit it and reduce everything to the nuclear issue. In my understanding, these two countries now can work together. God, in different ways, I mean, giving them this opportunity, a unique opportunity. They have same enemies in the region. The enemies that both suffered for decades from these fundamentalists, from these hardliners. So that's the opportunity that they should sit with each other and not only talk about that, I mean, nuclear issue, but see how they can work in the larger scope in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria. Iran can be used as a source of peace rather than we look at it as a source of conflict.
We have about 35 minutes for questions. I have to tell you that Ayatollah Iravani was also in Iraq, so if you have questions about Iraq, you might raise them. And I also have to tell you that Cardinal McCarrick has been very active in the religious diplomacy concerning the Middle East peace process. And if you have heard the news and read the newspapers this morning, there's not much peace right now in Gaza. But with that, I would like to turn to the audience for questions. Who would like to be first? Barbara?
You're looking at me. Yes. Sorry, I'm sure I can think of something.
Oh, sorry.
Alan, it's a pleasure to see you up there for a change.
Good.
And me down here, and a pleasure to meet Cardinal and to see Ayatollah Iravani again. I guess, you know, to be the skeptic as a journalist, yeah, as someone who supports U.S.-Iran exchanges, what do you say to those who say you're being naive, you know, you go and they give you lovely food and you speak to people who say nice things to you, but, you know, the Quds Force is in charge of what Iran does in Iraq or what Iran does in Syria, and religion may be important to them, but they have other interests, such as supporting Hezbollah, supporting the Mahdi army or Asab al-Haq or any of these other groups. You know, how do you deal with that argument that you may be men of good faith and you may be meeting with people of good faith, but they're not really running the show?
We'll give a chance. Who would like to go first?
Well, I can begin on it. If we never did anything in our lives except things of which we were 100% certain, we would be sitting here for the rest of our time. I think, you know, there are very few certainties. The only certainty we have is that God loves us. I believe that's really when it finally comes to the final basis. So that, yes, I think there are people who would be skeptical. Yes, I think there would be people who would have all kinds of examples and historic instances that they would cite. But I do believe, as the Ayatollah said, this is a new moment. And if we don't accept a new moment, we may never find it again. I think our American diplomacy should be sprightly enough that it is aware of new moments and looks after new moments. Now, will we have other opportunities to solidify what we are going to do? I would hope so. I think our dealings with other countries often are carrot and stick as well. And I would suspect that you will not have an international policy for any country, hopefully for any country, that says, whatever you do, fine, we'll see you. No, we always say, well, no, we expect you to do this, we expect you to do that, we expect this will be a test, this will be a way we'll see it going. And I think countries will accept that, because that's part of diplomacy, that's part of living together. Just as they will say to us, well, now if we're going to do this for you, you know what, let us look at the sanctions, let us look at your positions on things, let us look at your positions with other countries which may be inimical to us. I think there's a give and take, but I think without the give and take, there's no diplomacy. We're not dealing with mathematics. You know, we're dealing with people and how people think, so that, number one, I think we are naive if we think that we can never trust anybody. And number two, this is the world's worst diplomacy. This is the essence of isolationism. When we say the only ones we can trust are each other, you go up to the top of the hill, nobody would say that. And then thirdly, it seems to me that diplomacy means that there's a give and take. And I think Iran is willing to have a give and take, as long as it's done equally, as long as it's done acknowledging the dignity of both parties. Now, we're talking about the only empire that the Roman Empire never was able to overcome was the Persian Empire. And so we're dealing with a nation that's been around for a long time, not a fly-by-night gang that's come into the group. So that, I think there are cautions. This makes common sense, but there are also a need for us to seize a moment, not without guidance, not without different ways of guarding what we hold dear and what we hold necessary. But I think if we don't seize the moment, we end up paying for it in the end.
Ayatollah?
Yes. First of all, I think we should not underestimate or exaggerate the role of religious leaders when are traveling to, let's say, Iran or any other countries. We have limitations. But at the same time, we should not limit our role in those issues and concerns you mentioned. There are many areas that are out of our power or understanding, and we don't know about the facts or realities because we don't have enough information. I mean, everyone is claiming, you are claiming some people claiming Hezbollah as a terrorist, the other claiming them as a heroes. So we don't want to get into that part. What we are emphasizing when we are traveling is the full side of the water, of the glass, the positive side of each country is that they can be used and the elements that can be used to reduce misunderstanding. As I said earlier, for example, in the trip which we made, many of us, Muslims towards Christians, Christians towards Muslims, our information is not updated towards each other's, towards like philosophical issues, theological issues. So we are learning from each other. Or there are many areas that we can help each other to have a better life for our children. Let's take the issue of environment. Let's take the issue of family issues. So these are the issues that we can also contribute. I'm in my trip to Iraq, for example, I met with the custodians of the shrines. You know, for example, the shrines are very highly respected, unfortunately, has been destroyed, unfortunately, by this Daesh and others, ISIS, these days. But however, is a core part of the tradition and the rituals of the Shia's doctrine in particular are using lots of lights and energy day and night. So in my meeting with them, I was telling them, look, I know here there are some churches, some synagogues that are using green energies. Would be good if we can make a kind of connection and help you also to use that as a kind of example to show to the whole your people that you as a religious leaders, as a shrine custody, have concern about saving energies as well. So they should They love the idea. So it's on our shoulder here now to help them. This kind of stuff is happen. So the scope of cooperation is really a lot between the religious leaders, but at the same time, we should not expect more than what they can do.
All right. Right here, please.
Right there.
Concerning Iraq in particular.
Could you identify yourself, please?
Yeah, I'm James Wiseman from St. Anselm's Abbey.
Okay.
Concerning Iraq in particular, given that its boundaries were drawn up about a century ago by colonial powers somewhat casually, what do either of you see as the pros and cons of allowing the country to be divided into more or less three entities, one mainly Kurdish, one Sunni and one Shia?
Father Abbott, I can answer that one. I have the answer, but I have an opinion on it. I truly believe that the mistakes that the politicians of past generations made are still haunting us, and not only in the Middle East but in Africa. The terrible genocides of the Great Lakes regions 25 years ago, and the problems that we see in so many parts of Africa are because they drew lines on a map, not looking at tribal presence, not looking at natural opportunities, not looking at natural resources, and cutting some people off from others. So in Africa, this is very true, but it's very true here in the Middle East. So I'm sure the Ayatollah would know much more than I. I have to confess that, and I speak just for myself and for nobody else, but I have to confess that I was not happy with our nation trying to force the Kurdish autonomous region back into unity with Baghdad. I truly believe they have nothing to gain from that. And a leader of a people who sees pressure from a friendly country like the United States is put into a very difficult position when he realizes that he's being cheated out of oil revenue. He's not getting any support for his schools. And almost nothing is happening that will allow him to move forward. Whereas I was in Kurdistan 2 years ago, and it was surprised to see Christian schools flourishing, surprised to see churches and synagogues open, surprised to see a general sense of harmony among the people. I would hate to see that go. This is a Muslim nation, but I would hate to see that go. They understand who they are, and they want their children and old children to grow and to be able to function. The only problem with that, Father, I think, is that whereas we can see a Kurdish nation in the northeastern part of the country, where we could certainly see a very strong Shia population with great majorities in the southwestern part of the country. We still face this Islamic State that used to be the ISIS group. And I don't really know how we can deal with them as reasonable nations, and we have to do it. Obviously, we have to. They're there, but what is already happening is that the southeastern part of Iraq and the southwestern part of Syria are combining to make a rather large and powerful and oil-rich area. If it is going to be at peace with its neighbors, then that's fine. But from what we have seen so far, there's so much hate there and so much antagonism there That's, you know, all the things that I would say, that the three part, which I think is probably what we would look at. Will it survive because of the philosophy of this new nation? And will it be able to be a partner with the states around it?
Maybe we can turn to you, Ayatollah. Yes. You have views on the possible partition of Iraq, or maybe I should say recognition of what is a de facto state at this point.
Yes, nice to have you, Father Wiseman, with us here today, and thank you for your question. I was in Iraq a few days before all recent crises started. And that was my second trip during last few months into Iraq. And I made another trip like 2 years ago to Kurdistan as well with a group of American religious leaders as well. My reading when I went to Iraq and I traveled from, let's say, Kurdistan and to different parts of Iraq, I was really almost about to cry for this nation. To why this nation are going through this suffering. Why they have not been lucky to enjoy their life for decades. At least let's go back to like 30 years ago, from 30, 35 years ago, they had an imposed war against Iran that took lots of life of both nations. And Saddam as a dictator ran that country for years. And unfortunately, immediately after that, although the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. created lots of hope for the people that now they are getting rid of Saddam and then they are going to enjoy freedom, democracy and equality, but that was not the case. And still, after years of that invasion and collapse of Saddam, people are suffering. The whole nation are suffering. There is no enough road. There is, except the Kurdistan is exception somehow for different reason. But the rest of the Iraq are really poor in spite of they are rich. They are rich. They are one of the richest countries in the whole world. Now, adding to the poor and poverty and the suffering of the people, the mismanagement of the administrations. And again, I cannot blame them 100%. They are elected by the people. That's the price this nation pays because they have not been given opportunity to be educated, to be learned. There is no school for them. There is no education system for them. There is nothing there. So corruption is there. Then there are lots of different forces are working in that country. Adding to that, now the recent inputs and pressure of outsiders that now they want to extend the problem of Syria towards Iraq and later on maybe, who knows, towards Saudis, towards Iran and elsewhere and put the whole region in the fire. So it's a very, very bad and pity situation for Iraq nation. I personally do not like to see that kind of three entities in the region. It's not good for Iraqi people. It's not good for us as an Iranian. But however, if it happens, it happens. And then we have to be again ready to reduce the casualties, to reduce the downsides of that partitions. What you mentioned about like the history and how colonialists made this, if we want to take that, then the whole region is going to be under question. It's not only Iraq. I mean, if you look at the divisions, so we should know. I don't think that's the issue. So hopefully I'm optimistic again that with the influence of clergies, especially Grand Ayatollah Sistani, that's one of the area where that we can see how religion and religious leader and leadership played a very important and positive role in somehow keeping this nation together. And we hope that by now the support of Ayatollah Sistani towards one nation and asking for some changes within the system and administration, and also hoping that the negotiation between Iran and U.S. go in a positive way. And if it goes in positive way and these two countries decides to work with each other to solve the problem of the religion, then hopefully we won't see that has been predicted these days.
Okay. I'd like to take a question in the far back here, please, and please identify yourself.
Thank you. My name is Muhammad Ahmed. I am honored, like many of the audience here, to be here and hear you guys giving us this talk. I'm from Sudan and a recent graduate from the University of Rochester, upstate New York. And my question is regarding the youth. There's so much of deficiency when it comes to education, whether we're talking about the Middle East, North Africa, or some other places. And those of us who are lucky enough to come to schools and study and graduate with the hopes of going back home and doing a lot of great stuff and connecting the youth between, you know, not only the U.S., but across the board, and all of us trying to connect and get these ideas work out. We find ourselves in a very, very rough situation, not only because of the little political views or things that have gone wrong, but also we're, instead of considered an asset for current sort of leaderships and dividends for the future, we're considered threats most of the time. Like, lots of young people sort of view our leaders with a very, very sort of, you know, negativity, and that's because it goes way both ways. So whenever youth, they would try to do programs, they try to do awareness into certain policies or, you know, religion talks, we find ourselves in between rocks and hard places. And what role can you guys sort of do as religious leaders to sort of mitigate that for us so we can pave the way for better understanding, at least amongst the youth? Thank you.
Is the question how to encourage understanding among youth?
No, how to encourage leaders of, like, Sudan's country to accept and acknowledge the role of youth. Right. Am I understood you?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, since you understood it so well, you might want to begin.
But now you understood so well as well, Father, and always I have respect for you to start. And then we have like a footnote to what you're saying.
I'm trapped. My dear friend, I think that your question is a very important one. But it's a question that goes to leaders everywhere. You know, not just in our country, not just religious leaders who are Muslim or Christian or Jewish or Buddhist. It goes to everyone. It goes to every adult who plays a role in society, whether he's a leader in government or a leader in religion or a leader in business or a leader in education. The need to see that you have to look not just with the eyes of today, which you have to do, otherwise you lose your balance, but you have to look with the eyes of tomorrow also. You cannot survive. No nation can survive without preparing its young people for tomorrow. And I think this is very important in so many areas. Let me just take a moment to digress and say, we are very blessed in the United States with wonderful Islamic leaders. And I think that we are some very, very fine people. ISNA and these other groups and the group that my friend Ayatollah Rouhani is working with. These are very, very fine people. And they are not just looking at the problems of today, which, as you see, are grave enough, but they're looking at tomorrow. And I think it is so important. A few years ago, the Islamic Society of North America issued a fatwa, they themselves, having discussed it and prayed over it, a fatwa saying that suicide bombing was not supported by the Quran. You cannot kill innocent people. And this was a very, very important fatwa. And they presented to me actually at a meeting which we had at the Washington National Press Club here in our city. It was a very important moment, and it was read out loud by Dr. Siddiqui, who was at that time the president of ISNA. It was echoed by many other Muslim leaders, and I received it on behalf of all of us who are not Muslims, who were delighted to see this courageous stand by our own Islamic leadership in the United States.
Excuse me.
One last sentence. It never got any publicity. It never got any publicity. I could ask you how many heard about this great fatwa, and half of you would say we never heard. And that's one of the problems that we face.
I told any
just
comments?
In short, yes, just in short, I mean, Muhammad, thank you for putting this question and showing your interest that you want to go back to your country. Unfortunately, many other youths who are coming here, even they don't want to go back to their country. So I appreciate that you have still that connection with your country, and that's something should be appreciated. And of course, you should not give up easily. These days you can use lots of medias and lots of internet facilities in order to connect to your people, and in a positive way also start talking to even your leaders and try to use different elements, clergymen in your country. So since I haven't been unfortunately there and I don't know exact tools and ways of getting into, so I cannot talk in particular about that, but that's a general guidance which I'm encouraging you. Have more people like you and try to show to them that rather than you are interested in changing their system or political system, you want to help the country more in general, to build it, to help, to bring technology to your country, to bring health and other stuff. And then through that, ultimately the system is going to correct itself. But if you want to show yourself as just a political young activist, then always there is a kind of hesitation to let you in, or that's my advice to you.
The questions. Let's take two of these right here. Here and here.
Hossein Shahbazi with Webster University. Thank you so much for all your positive remarks. And also for putting together this wonderful panel. My questions involves the reactions in this country, and that regards both the religious communities beyond the Christian communities. I'm talking about Jewish communities and Protestant communities, how the leaders and clerics have reacted to your trip, as well as I'm sure that, you know, you must have met with the U.S. officials. I would be interested to know if they had, beyond the public sentiments that they express about fatwa and others, if they have received you more than we think you would have been. Thank you very much.
Okay, over here.
Thank you very much. I'm Benjamin Tour, retired American diplomat. Pope Francis, like Ayatollah Khamenei, is both a religious leader and the leader of a state. That makes his rather extraordinary initiative in inviting and getting the presidents of Israel and of Palestine to come to the Vatican to pray and think together. I'm wondering how you view the significance of this extraordinary gesture, which is a departure, it seems to me, for the church, suggests some changes, and what would be the next or follow-on steps to this move?
All right, two questions. Reaction to by U.S. officials, government officials, to your ideas, and then I think the second question is clearly for you, Cardinal Garrick, as to...
Does that mean he gets the first one?
Well, if you would like it, if you'd like it, Ayatollah, please take it.
Yes.
Both can answer the second question.
Yes, both can answer both. Would you like to go ahead?
Yes, I mean, answering your question, I have been receiving, I came back 3-4 days ago, but so far, some positive remarks from my colleagues who are running different mosques or centers, and also what I have been hearing from the rest of group who came, also they are receiving a very good welcoming. We haven't had anything negative, and they are telling the stories to their own people, to their own churches, sharing what they have seen, what they have experienced. Now, in terms of American officials, I haven't been able, because as I said, in like 2-3 days, but before our departure, we have been in touch, we have got their blessing, and always they are supporting. There is a faith-based initiative office and diplomacy in the state, and in more details, I think Cardinal can refer to that question as well. Then I can go later on after you.
But I'll go to that. That's the first question there. I think that when we came back, you report to your own people, you report to the bishops and what you've seen and heard and what you have understood there. And I think oftentimes it gets into the press. I've seen already some articles in the press about the visit of the American bishops to that area, so that there's a certain amount of publicity, a certain amount of carryover that goes with that. My basic platform, I guess you could say, would be this NILI that you mentioned before, this National Interreligious Leadership Initiative, basically for peace in the Holy Land, but it's really for peace in all of the Middle East. And so there is where I would meet with Jewish and Protestant and other Christian leaders, so that what we learn from these areas and what we learn from my friend, who is much smarter than most of us, maybe all of us, we share with the other members of NILI. And NILI, this NILI has been around for many years. We do several times a year have a meeting with our State Department people to say where we are and basically to ask them where they are, you know, and what where they think we can be useful and where they think we should be pressing for the things that we believe very strongly. So that would be the only channels that we would have, and I think I agree with what the Ayatollah was saying, and that he would receive calls and things like that, for both from friends and from politicians. Not necessarily they're not friends, but from friends and from other people whose work is involved more closely with that.
Cardinal, I wonder if you would say a few words about Pope Francis' visit to the Middle East, to Jerusalem. I know you were along on the trip because I called him. He had his cell phone on, and it was 11:30 at night. So,
if it was anybody else, I would have gotten annoyed.
I see. Thank you.
Well, I think to answer that diplomat's question too, what I would expect from, well, first of all, what Pope Francis did, what I expect from his initiative. I don't know, and I'm not sure any of us know. I think he felt that this was a moment in which I said earlier, there was the attempt to the carpe diem. You got to hold on to the moment. You got to when you have possibilities. And I think Holy Father felt that people were listening because the whole world was around and paying attention, that this is the time to say, can't we work for peace together? And so he invited the presidents of the two entities, and they came and they prayed together. I think when you weigh what the Holy Father does, you have to put in another quotient that usually we don't think of, and that's prayer. Because how often, if I would say to myself even, how are we going to fix this? The people who would say, well, we're going to pray, are in the vast minority. Holy Father wants to change that. He wants us to go back to the days when we really felt that there is value in prayer. There is strength in prayer. There is force in prayer. There are answers in prayer. And I think he brought them together and they prayed together. And he made it very clear that this should not be the end of the prayer. That if you get other people to pray, the people in the other people in the government of Palestine and the government of Israel to pray, and to bring their theological, their spiritual lives to face this. You sometimes when you deal with these issues, and it happens in our own government too, you are just looking at the basics that you know, how much do they have? How much do we have? How much do we need to give? How much do we need to take? And not saying, okay, now, you know, there is a God up above, and he's involved. He's a God of prayer, a God of peace. You know, we call Jesus the Prince of Peace, and certainly, I think among the great names of Allah is his peace. He is peace, and certainly in the Jewish religion, the peace is so important. Jerusalem's Beth Salem is a city of peace. You say salam and shalom, so that people are interested in peace and where peace comes from. And so I think to answer your question, maybe not as optimistically as I would like to, because people aren't listening to that extra degree. But I think it's there, and I think what the Holy Father did, what the Holy Father said, and the Holy Father's prayer isn't over. And I still have hopes that something will come out of it. What we see in these last few days, of course, has been horrible, and what caused it even more horrible, the deaths of these young people. But, I think we have to face that, and that's a setback. But we have to move forward. And I think from what the Holy Father is asking us to do, is to just do that, you know, not to say it's over. It's never over, as long as God's in his heaven, and that's going to be a long time.
Cardinal, I would just remark too that the Vatican will be hosting the third Christian-Muslim summit in December. Which is a step in this direction as well. You have a quick comment, and then we have a final question.
My respect to all previous popes in the history of Catholicism and recent years, this is one of those exceptionals, man of God, that I really impress in different ways by what he is doing. He's not only limiting himself to Christians, he's for everyone. He's like Jesus, I think, somehow try to be like him. And I really appreciate what he's doing. And that would be a good idea, I think. He can play his role more positively towards Iran, U.S. and the Middle East, not to limit his initiatives towards Israel-Palestinian issue. Can be also a good initiative created by him, maybe to bring the leaders around the fatwa that, as you mentioned, I'm sure he is against also the use of weapon of mass destruction. He's against of killing any innocent people. Iran's supreme leader has, there are many other Muslims and other Jews and Christian leaders. So that would be a good maybe reason for him to lead that kind of initiative in the near future.
Okay. A final question. Let's take the lady right back here, please.
Leah Muskin-Puet from the Project on Middle East Democracy. I'm just curious, especially about your 2003 trip, because at the time that it sounds like you went on a trip, a pro-peace trip that was interfaith, at the same time the U.S. government at least was very outright about being pro-war and was using only slightly veiled, very Islamophobic rhetoric, and, you know, that went down from NYPD spying on American Muslims to, you know, all this rhetoric of why do they hate our freedoms? I mean, you had a government that in the United States that was peddling Islamophobia, and while that may have changed slightly, you still have a lot of politicians in America, as well as a lot of.
What's the question, please?
I'm just wondering, when you went on this trip that was pro-peace and interfaith, but you have politicians on all different sides that are less interested in interfaith and less interested in peace. How do you navigate that?
Would you like to have a sort of a one-liner answer from both of you?
Yes, I mean, first of all, it was not the case in Iran. We had President Khatami when we were in Iran, who was advocate of peace. And here they really wanted peace. And the second also, in this part, although some politicians were seeking kind of war, but they were not all of them. Maybe the misinformation we're giving to them led them to Iraq invasion. That was the case to maybe invade or attack Iran as well. So this trip contributed to the better understanding of the Iranian community and society, a dynamic society, when they came back and they gave a report to the officials here. So that was effective in changing their mindsets towards understanding better Iran and do not rely on wrong information.
Cardinal Carrick, you have the final word.
The final word was it was wonderful to be with Ayatollah Irani because he says things much better than I could. And I think what he was saying there is so true. There are many visions, there are many words, there are many ideas. We have to find the core idea. And if the core idea is hatred, the core idea is war, the core idea is destruction, wherever it is, whether it's in the Holy Land, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's in Latin America, wherever it is, the core idea can't be that. The core idea has to be, we're all brothers and sisters in God's one human family. And if we can live that way and learn that way, then we can get along much better.
Ayatollah, you have a...
Yes, I just want to let you know that we are here at, I mean, we are blessed with this country. We are U.S. citizen. We want to serve this nation. We are part of this nation. We want to have a better reputation of this country and this nation towards the Middle East. And with very humble facilities that I have here and my friends and colleagues have here and the center which we have, we are ready, a call away from any of you who would like in any ways to contribute to the peace and dialogue in the Middle East. So please come to us and share with us your interests, and we try to be your best friend and helper. God bless all of you. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very, very much.